Because of listeners like you, Preborn has helped to rescue over 67,000 babies. Your $28 to sponsor one ultrasound doubled a baby's chance at life. Your tax-deductible gift saves lives. Please join us in this mission. To donate, go to preborn.com/AFR.
Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
I love talking about the things of God because of truth and the biblical worldview.
The U.S. Constitution obligates our government to preserve and protect the rights that our founders recognize come from God, our Creator, not our government. I believe that Scripture in the Bible is very clear that God is the one that raised up each of you, and God has allowed us to be brought here to this specific moment in time.
This is Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Good morning. It is Thursday, October 16th, and the big news this morning is that it looks like the Supreme Court will end the Democrat charade of DEI districts. That was actually from our good friend Mike Davis, Article 3 Project founder. He told War Room Steve Bannon yesterday that the Supreme Court will end the charade of DEI districts unless there's clear evidence of racial discrimination. Davis argued that Democrats don't care about minority representation. They only care about Democrat representation. And that is absolutely true. The Supreme Court heard arguments yesterday in the Voting Rights Act racial redistricting case. And coming from Daybreak Insider, one of the unintended consequences of the Voting Rights Act was the creation of legislative districts by race, which clearly violates the Equal Protection Clause. The Supreme Court heard that case that challenges the practice of drawing congressional districts by race, but the New York Times had a different opinion, of course. It said the Supreme Court appeared poised on Wednesday to weaken a key provision of a landmark civil rights law. Notice how they phrase all of this, you know, weaken it, and it's a landmark civil rights law. Like, this is, you know, going to tear down our country, and how dare they? We're going back to the Jim Crow era, guys, you know. But so they said, you know, this is a landmark civil rights law by sharply limiting the ability of lawmakers to use race as a factor in drawing voting maps, which could lead to widespread redistricting efforts. And yeah, they're really concerned about that, because if districts are actually drawn without DEI and race-based, then Republicans are poised to gain potentially 19 or 20 seats in the House. And so New York Times and the Democrats are really freaking out about this, because they can't win on the basis of their philosophy. They can't win on the basis of actually convincing voters. They've just been using a lot of tactics to remain in power for decades upon decades. And now that the Supreme Court is actually looking at a lot of different ways, they're out of power moves. They're just out of it. And so the New York Times goes on to say, if the justices determine that lawmakers cannot consider race when drawing districts, the consequences for the country's political balance could be sweeping. The decision could end the practice endorsed by the court for decades. You know, again, notice how they're appealing to, like, hey, we a landmark precedent. We can never overturn this. Of course they can. Of crafting congressional districts with the purpose of helping minority voters elect the candidates of their choice. So now, you know, this always goes back to, like, democracy is in peril, right? But overarchingly, this is all about weakening the Democrats' power grab and actually returning the country to the way that districts were supposed to be drawn. And we're going to have more on that with one of our favorite lawyers coming up. But first, I want to bring in one of our famous and favorite theologians, and, you know, maybe doomsday prophets is what I like to call them. But our good friend, Steve Dace, because Steve, I think overarchingly, though, this is more about recognizing that we're at a crossroads in this country, because the Democrats have been trying this power grab for decades instead of actually having a philosophy that can build this country. And they can't be reasoned with anymore. I mean, this isn't something where it's like, you know, we're all kind of going in the same direction and we just have a little bit different policy ideas of how to get there. I mean, this is no longer actual Americans all agreeing on what a moral and upright society looks like. This is literally the difference between reshaping America into a progressive ideology versus actually keeping America. And it shouldn't be that way.
Right on the money there, Jenna. So let me address this actually theologically. And then I have a legal question for you, if that's okay. All right.
All right. All right. I'm ready.
So theologically, let me reiterate. Number one, I've said this on your show before. We are permitted to do whatever it takes to win, except that which God says in his word we can't do. And I think it's very important for audiences, particularly people as engaged as those who support and follow the American Family Association, to understand this. And the thing I love about AFA is they've already pushed the boundaries of what's acceptable and aggressive and your typical Christian leader, nicer than God, Pensian furrow brow, church of successor, perpetual sisterhood of acquiescence. They've already been doing that for decades. So that won't necessarily be a foreign message to this audience. But outside of audiences like this, that Christians are going to have to learn that actually, if anything, we're not even close to the boundary line of what God says we're not allowed to do or to win. If you study his word, we're not even close to it. All right. We're going by these traditions and unwritten rules that are just all a complete and total Pharisaical farce to emasculate us. All right, to handcuff us. So that's number one. And you're not going to get to number one if you care what your enemies think of you. You're just not. All right, so get over that. And the person you need to worry about offending is God. And short of everything that he says you can't do in his word, and it's pretty simple. We know what we can't do. He gave us 10 of those things. Can't worship other gods, can't make other gods, right? Stuff like that, all right? Can't lie, can't bear false witness, can't steal, can't murder. So we already know what we can't do. Everything short of that, though, we are permitted to do and, in fact, should be doing. What does the master say to the servant who took his talent and buried it because he was afraid that he could live up to what was expected of him, or he'd be judged too harshly, or he'd be viewed too harshly? Depart from me, you wicked servant, into the den of iniquity. All right, so take what you have and do everything, whatever voice you have, whatever platform you have, whatever gifts and times and talents and treasures you have, and do everything to win short of what the Word of God says you can't. All right, that's number one. And no matter what you think of this case or not, you're already a racist for daring to challenge them on any power level whatsoever, so just get over that. That's number one. Number two, race is not a construct biblically. The Bible basically divides people into Jews and Gentiles, sinners and saints. So the construct of race as we know it simply just does not exist within a biblical worldview. And that's why in previous eras, those who sought to define people as lesser based on the amount of melanin in their skin, they were wicked and immoral. And those that now in our day and age, so we had racists in previous eras, I would say we have racialists in this era. Those who claim to say that you now have been given some sort of special permanent exemption victimhood status because of the melanin level. Like we had a Supreme Court justice literally say yesterday, black people are, quote, disabled, and she's black. You know, what's ironic is that's the same language that would have been used in the Jim Crow South for why blacks couldn't get access to polling places. Same language. Just completely turned to a different context. Why? Because they're actually both Ketanji and the Klan. Both those K's are starting from the same exact premise, as a matter of fact. They just drew different conclusions, but they started from the exact same demonic, ungodly, pagan premise. So race is not a construct as we define it in a worldly sense. It does not exist within a biblical worldview. So you can just completely and totally just dismiss that aspect from your thinking as well. So you give yourself moral permission to reconsider these situations. So I think those are two very important theological understandings of this moment, because frankly, every generation, has its blind spots. And I know that a lot of our boomer parents and grandparents are very sensitive to this because they've been falsely smeared as racist most of their adult lives. And Barack Obama literally got elected on white guilt. I know people in my family that voted for Obama and then cried when he won because they thought we had finally shed the racism that they'd been imbued with. And then by the end of this term, we're like, how did I vote for this guy? He's a complete and total communist. I'm sure there's a lot of people in this audience that have family members that have a similar story to that. You know, we hear things like first black woman to do this TV. I was messing around on Twitter last night, watching some very old football clips on a Twitter account that is like taking a bunch of football films, games from the 70s and 80s, and puts them up online. I'm watching a 1972 Eagles-Rams game where the two color commentators are black. In 1972, Jenna, that's before you and I were born, all right? So it's time to get over this. It's time to move on. All right. If we have any wrongs that need to be addressed, it's in this culture nowadays, it's actually in the other direction. We're now marginalizing people because of the lack of melanin in their skin. So this racialism is completely demonic, cannot be tolerated. It's why we don't put woke and DEI in the churches. It's why we don't genuflect to George Floyd in the churches. This is why. All right. Because that is festering and feeding this demonic pagan system that is meant to divide us. And you can always tell what is satanic whenever its first fruit and initial intent is to immediately slander and divide the brethren. That's how you always know something is satanic. And this entire agenda fits that to a T. Which brings me to my legal question. You know, we're already seeing some judges that are attempting to thwart the Supreme Court saying earlier this year, ixnay on all these universal injunctions. Are we just going to see years and years of court challenges now? If we go back and attempt to redistrict these things properly, are they just going to run to federal court right away to challenge this and say, this is racial animus, this is race, and these things could take months, if not years, to adjudicate on an individual basis?
Of course they will, because they're not going to ever just give up and say, you know, oh, okay, we lost at the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court, of course, is, you know, the ones that we hold up to be the highest court in the land. And I mean, they do that, of course, when the opinion is the way that they prefer. And of course, you know that, Steve. And yet then when it's the conservative wing of the Supreme Court that actually gets the five or more votes, then suddenly it's an illegitimate decision and all of these other lower court federal judges, you know, need to narrow the opinion. They need to apply it in different ways. And so they have continued to use lawfare in so many different ways well before Donald Trump even came on scene. And so hopefully the Supreme Court won't allow that, and there will be more expedited opinions and ways that it can go back up to the Supreme Court, and they can say, no, you know, this redistricting is actually going to happen. The concern, of course, for the Democrats is that the redistricting will happen even before the midterms. It really depends on when this opinion is out. But of course, I mean, the Democrats and the left never give up. And that's actually something that we need to add to our arsenal and our playbook, because too often if we lose at the Supreme Court, we just go, we tried. Okay, right, I guess that's the way it's going to be. We don't have that sort of steadfastness. All right, we need to reinvent our strategy. But you said something, though, that's my opinion on the legal part of it. But you said something that is so important, Steve, is that race is not a biblical thing. There is one race, there is the human race. And for all of this nonsense that the left has been pushing, and I love how you put it, instead of racism, it's now racialism, and they are trying to marginalize anyone who doesn't fit into their preferred status of this. I mean, the left and any other worldview besides the Christian worldview has always had some kind of hierarchy to determine which humans have a better preferred status than others. And it's always been whatever status helps the left get to their goal. Because if more...
This is an important point you're making. Yes.
If more blacks voted Republican, then you wouldn't see them making this argument at all. So it's not actually about their concern about, you know, women or blacks or, you know, any other of this nonsense. It's that they want to use anything to get to their preferred outcome. And Christians need to not worry about being called racist.
Pardon me. That's exactly correct. If Republicans consistently got 20% of the black vote nationwide, Democrats could literally win an election nowhere.
Yeah.
Literally nowhere. Literally nowhere in America could a Democrat win an election of consequence if Republicans got 20% of the black vote nationwide. And that is and that's why this sort of the most incendiary language possible is continually used in their messaging. And here's how you can also tell if something is demonic or godly in the public realm. From the beginning of the church, Christians have wrestled with how much power in this world to seek, since ultimately our kingdom is not of this world. How much of the power of this world to seek, how much of it to wield. There is a constant tension that within Christianity about, well, do we do it on a temporary basis? Even after the Reformation, a group called Anabaptists were formed right away. That's where your Quakers and Mennonites and Amish traditions come from that said, hey, we are to divorce ourselves from this world. This world's problems are not our own. They wrestled at the Constitutional Convention with whether or not rebelling against the King of England was a violation of Romans 13. All right. And so this is a constant tension within Christianity about the wielding of power and how much to seek the powers of this world. In the world system or any other religious system like Islam, which is part of the world system, I would argue, there is no such tension. But instead, power and its achievement and acquisition is the means to an end in and of itself. It is the chief means in and of itself. And so everything the left does, and you just define this in what you just said, you'll notice that everything the left does is about power and control. Let me say that again. Everything the left does is about power and control. The ultimate fruit of everything they seek to do is either to maintain or to grow their power and control. I remember something Rick Santorum said years ago, that even after seeing how many seats they lost in Congress after doing Obamacare, Democrats would have done it all over again anyway, because it gave them the power and control that they wanted. And that's one of the most brilliant political analyses I've heard in my career. That's exactly right. Someone who doesn't just know politics, but really knows theology, philosophy, and the larger forces at work with that observation. It's always about power and control. And so while we wrestle correctly on our side, right, we serve a Lord who's King of the universe, right? As we reign, as we speak right now, he is reigning over the universe right now. And yet in this stage of our humanity, we don't fully sense the fullness of his power and authority yet in our daily lives, in the way that we live on this planet in its unredeemed state. And so that tension exists within our framework and worldview. There is no such tension that exists in the demonic worldly worldview at all, but instead it's only about power and control, which tells you who their true master and true father is.
Absolutely, because that was the first original sin in the garden, was the promise that you will be like God, and what is God, all-knowing and all-powerful. But here's the other thing, Steve, and you're absolutely right on this, is that Christians, while there is this tension, we need to not be afraid of wielding the power, the delegated authority, maybe, rather, if we want to use
right,
that term, if Christians are too
is.
Afraid of power,
is, right?
Right? We need to not be afraid of the delegated authority that God has given, so that the institutions are do what they are supposed to do, which is to preserve and protect the rights that come from God, our Creator. I mean, imagine if parents didn't wield their delegated authority and their power of parenting enough, and they were too afraid and said, oh, you know, I don't want to overstep, and so I don't want to discipline my kids, I don't want to make rules in my house, I don't want to wield my power that God has given me, because it might be, you know, too much. And certainly we've seen that power abused in certain instances. Yes, we need to always have that balance, but we can't be afraid of wielding government power. And that is the thing that I love about Ron DeSantis. I absolutely love about him is that he is not afraid to wield power for the purposes for which it was intended. And he is possibly the only Republican in the executive office other than Donald Trump who, and both of them share this mindset. They are not afraid to wield power for their best outcome, because they know that power can be used for good. And Christians need to get back to that. So we have to take a break here in just a sec, but closing thoughts.
Again, the world demonic system is the seeking of power and control. The Christian worldview is meekness, which is power under control.
Yeah, power under control. So good. And we have to take a break here, but Steve, really appreciate it. This is such an important conversation because we have to understand what the left is trying to do with wielding their power in ways that go to arguments that are unbiblical, untruthful, don't even match reality, because race is not a thing. There is the human race, that's it. So our district lines in the United States that recognizes God's authority shouldn't be drawn based on something that is really a leftist construct, right? And then also on the flip side, Christians should not be afraid to wield our power and to fight in every way, Steve, as you very aptly put it, in every way that we can that is not prohibited by God our Creator. So well said. We'll be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. And we are talking about this Supreme Court oral argument from yesterday that discussed gerrymandering, redistricting of congressional maps, and limiting the Voting Rights Act so that districts cannot be drawn on the basis of race. And so I want to get into more of the legal on this and this case and exactly how this is going to affect the political map and all that. So we talked about the theology in the last segment with Steve, and now let's go more to the legal and welcome in Gerard Folletti, who is a senior counsel of the Lawfare Project. And so, Gerard, this case came out of Louisiana. And so give us kind of a brief overview. We've talked about some of the potential consequences, but for those who haven't heard exactly what the arguments were in this case, give us just a summary, if you could.
Well, in 2022, the state of Louisiana did redistricting, and they created one majority minority district, so heavily favoring black residents, but that was challenged as not being sufficient. They wanted more districts that were minority oriented. So in 2024, by 2024, they created another district, and that was challenged by a group of self-described non-African Americans who believed that the redistricting process was racist, that it favored black residents. And that came up to the Supreme Court. It was argued earlier this year, and now it was re-argued on an argument that the Chief Justice himself wanted more briefing on Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act and whether that is essentially constitutional, whether the use of race as the predominant factor in redistricting is something that needs to continue or is problematic under the 14th and 15th Amendments.
Yeah, and this is an important case. I mean, not only just in terms of the legal, and you know, we've seen how gerrymandering has worked in other contexts, and the Supreme Court, you know, this is not the first case that they've heard on the subject overall of districting, but this is also really important in terms of how this will affect the congressional map, because if the Supreme Court holds how everyone thinks that they will, and they'll, you know, strike down or at least weaken this provision of the Voting Rights Act or Section 2, then at least 19 or 20 districts would favor Republicans, which is the outcome that the Democrats don't want.
That's right. And that's what may very well affect electoral dynamics for years to come, is that they may shift the balance even more towards in favor of the Republicans in Congress. Now, it's interesting that the arguments yesterday, something that was brought up by the Office of the Solicitor General, so by the Trump administration, that in this country, you already have a number of majority-minority districts, the type that favor this racial gerrymandering, but you have more minority people that are elected to Congress than in those districts. So the suggestion that you still need to redistrict based on race is really not borne out by the facts. Americans seem to have moved on beyond the perception of color and race, which is very significant.
Yeah, and you know, and this argument overall that somehow representation necessarily means that you have to have a quota of people that fit into certain categories, like, you know, race or sex. Shouldn't we be past that as a country? I mean, you know, as a woman, you know, I don't currently, in my district, I have men who represent me and they're conservatives. And so I'm okay with that because I think that they actually represent, I'd rather have, you know, men who represent the way that I vote instead of a liberal woman or a Democrat woman, right? And so, I mean, shouldn't we be past this overall in terms of a legal and constitutional framework to suggest that somehow we need to draw district lines so that some characteristic of the individual has to represent what, you know, some segment of their district looks like?
That's exactly the question that many Americans are asking and agree with. And the Supreme Court arguments, you could see Justice Kavanaugh, for example, hinting in the same direction. It's when is enough enough? When have we remedied the past mistakes of our country, whether it was racism towards black people or sexism or anything else? And we're past that and we can start looking beyond color or religion or gender and start voting for people on their merits. And we saw this with the affirmative action cases that, for example, fair students at Harvard 2 years ago when the Supreme Court struck down this permission for racial consideration. The court's basically saying that we're in society at a point beyond that, and we want to look at the merits, not just color. We are becoming discriminatory in remedying past wrongs. So I think that's the direction the court was going yesterday as well in its questioning.
Yeah, and I'm speaking with Gerard Folletti, senior counsel of the Lawfare Project, about this Supreme Court oral argument yesterday. And in my last segment, my guest was saying, and I think very aptly, said, you know, we've gone from, you know, racism of the actual, you know, civil rights era and the Civil War era to racialism. And I think that's so apt of saying basically we need to have these preferred demographics that actually weaken the balance and the equality, really, of all Americans. And so it's like we've kind of reversed this, and somehow the left is suggesting that because of past wrongs, you know, over 100 years ago, now somehow we need to continue to make up for it when it really doesn't make sense. And then at what point, you know, was there any, and I didn't listen to the full argument yesterday, but was there any suggestion by some of the advocates who are saying, you know, this is ridiculous, that at what point then does this overcorrecting then actually have a disparate treatment impact on people who aren't part of that racial category? I mean, you know, there's no way, unless you don't actually look at race at all, which is what the point is of this case, I think, unless you don't look at it at all, then at some point you are still preferring one race over another. And somehow, you know, people like Ketanji Brown Jackson are suggesting it's okay now in 2025 to prefer blacks over any other shade of melanin, where then 100 years ago it was, well, we can't prefer blacks, and neither position is okay.
So right now, it looks like the liberal perspective is that in order to fix discrimination, you have to engage in discrimination, but in a different direction. And I think that's what especially the conservative justices were getting at in their questioning yesterday. But we've seen this throughout this Supreme Court, throughout the last few years, that there is this pushback by the Supreme Court on the use of race as a factor in fixing discrimination, that it really is a type of racial discrimination in itself to say that we need to favor one group over another in order to correct for past mistakes. I think the court and society are saying that we're beyond that point. And it's also interesting to point out that in a way, it's racism itself to suggest that minorities vote as a block, that they have this mindset that predisposes them towards one candidate or one position or one set of views. That's definitely not the case. Look at the last election. You know, Republicans are getting a lot of votes from minorities today that they may not have gotten 30 or 40 years ago. This suggests that we need to look at people and their individual preferences and not judge them on race. But that's exactly what liberals are doing. They're saying we want to pigeonhole all people into their race categories. And the Supreme Court, the conservatives, are pushing back.
Yeah. So, I mean, and this just seems to be such an ideological mess because, you know, you have the those on the left and the Democrats that, of course, they're pushing for this really not, you know, in my view, not because they actually believe in the merit of their argument, but because the outcome favors Democrats. And the Republicans on the other side, you know, are pushing for this because, one, it favors their outcomes, right? I mean, this would be 19 to 20 seats that are Republican, but, you know, should be drawn without these types of, you know, biases interfering. And so this seems to be like it's more ideologically driven than necessarily, you know, legal and constitutional, other than maybe saying, okay, well, on what basis can a legislature contemplate the district lines? I mean, that, of course, touches and concerns legal principles, but this seems to be, you know, very ideologically driven. How does the court parse through all of that?
I don't think that they do. I think that they start to limit Section 2. I think they start to limit the Voting Rights Act more to place less of an emphasis. They could say it's not permissible to use race as a dominant factor or a predominant factor, but you don't do away with it completely. I think that at the end of the day, it's easier for both liberals and conservatives to look at districts in terms of race than it is to look at the fact that America is very highly divided, and that in whatever district you look, and whatever race or however you categorize people, there will always be a minority that did not vote for the person who is representing them. And that's really the challenge. It's figuring out how to make sure that everyone's vote is heard. It's easy to do it on the basis of race. It's not so easy to do it on the basis of political preference. And that's really the challenge that legislatures need to do a better job at that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, we should expect our legislatures to actually do the work. And that's sad that we can't really expect them to do that. And that there are all of these other, you know, preferences and concerns that get in the way. But ultimately, when the court issues its opinion, and if it weakens or eliminates, you know, this ability under Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act to contemplate race, then the practical effect of this is the gaining of House seats, likely for Republicans. And so, you know, CNN was panicking yesterday over this, revealing that the left is kind of maxed out on gerrymandering and falling behind in the polls compared to where they think they should be in 2026. And so how exactly would this go if the Supreme Court issues their opinion, say as early as February, but maybe as late as July? Will this impact the midterms, or do you anticipate that there won't be time necessarily for legislatures to act on this without even more legal challenges?
I think it will absolutely impact the midterms. Texas has already started the redistricting process. If the court here rules in Louisiana's favor and invalidates this redistricting, then I think Texas will see that as giving it the ability to redistrict the way it wants to in favor of Republicans, and that will affect the midterms. I think other states like Ohio will also do the same. But there aren't, truthfully, that many states currently engaged in redistricting to make a huge difference in the midterms, more so down the line. But even in the midterms now, we've seen the shift, the gradual shift towards favoring Republicans. It's not going to be the, you know, the washout that normally happens in midterms. So every seat counts. And even if it's Texas and Ohio, a few additional seats that Republicans gain, that will make all the difference in them holding control of the House.
Yeah. And so, I mean, and so this will probably affect, because it is like, Texas is Republican controlled in terms of the legislature and, you know, other states. And so what about states like, you know, California, where their General Assembly is very heavily Democrat? Could this actually affect their ability to redistrict in favor of Democrats if they use this? You know, is there some kind of strategy in blue states that would affect it differently?
Not really, because the issue is that you can, it is legally permissible to redistrict for political reasons. So California could just redistrict to favor Democrats, and that would be permissible. And that's what they're likely to do, but not easily, because they still need to get past the referendum threshold, which in itself is proving to be somewhat of a challenge. But this also does allow Democrat-controlled legislatures to redistrict more in their favor. So it doesn't just go one way. It does cut both ways. Right now, we see it as favoring Republicans more, but in states like California, it can very easily favor Democrats.
Right. And so when we're talking about, you know, these 20 or so, I mean, you know, it could be less, seats that would be added to the GOP and, you know, and this would heavily favor then that balance and the control of the House. I mean, that would give Republicans a much wider margin in terms of pushing through their agenda. What states besides Texas are we really looking at in terms of potentially gaining those seats?
Well, Florida, Ohio, we might even see something in other Midwest states or southern states. That's the most likely place for it to happen. We could see something in Utah as well. But really right now, it's just Texas that's really the big one that's happening as we speak, the redistricting process, which may affect 5+ seats. And even that is a pretty significant number going into the midterms. But it's also interesting that, you know, the Democrats are essentially arguing for racism instead of looking at what policies Americans want and trying to get back to the center and implement policies that Americans care about, the economy, not transgenderism. Instead, they're trying to perpetuate racism in voting practices because that's the only way they see a path forward to gaining electoral votes.
Yeah, isn't it wild that Democrats are willing to justify literally any argument just to get to their preferred outcome? And, you know, if the tables were turned and it was the Republican side arguing for, you know, any of this, then it would be immediately denounced. And, you know, Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi and everybody else would be out there, you know, saying, look at the party of Hitler and this is racist and, you know, all of these ridiculous narratives. But somehow, you know, the left is fine making any argument as ridiculous and actually wrong as it is in order to get to their preferred outcome. And somehow they're almost never challenged just on that basis. And so, you know, the arguments yesterday, and I listened to part of this, but I mean, it was a little bit wild in my opinion, especially, you know, listening to some of the ridiculousness, just the utter ridiculousness from the bench, from not just Ketanji Brown Jackson, which, you know, I think was the most ridiculous, and Governor DeSantis actually had some choice words this morning. It was kind of funny. And for those of you who don't follow him on X, you should, because he said the arguments in favor of racial gerrymandering, as arguments in favor of racial gerrymandering go, and they are not persuasive in general, this one has got to be the bottom of the barrel. And he was talking about Jackson arguing for race-based redistricting, citing the Americans with Disabilities Act. I mean, it's just so ludicrous. But then also Sotomayor. I mean, so some of these arguments, they're just so not persuasive. And we've got to take a break here, but less comment on, you know, just the arguments overall, because I can't believe that justices of the Supreme Court are actually making these arguments from the bench.
It almost looks like they were trying to justify racism, and that's really disturbing. We've gotten to the point where the left is so obsessed with getting their perspective that anything they do that's discriminatory is social justice. But if the Republicans do it, then it's criminal. So really, we saw that carry out in the arguments yesterday, and that really seems to be the trend coming from the left.
Yes. Well, Gerard Folletti, we're going to hold you over through the break because we have more to talk about. And we'll be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning. And that was Copper weighing in, and he wants a snack in the break. So we'll be right back. We're living in a time when truth is under attack. Lies are easy to tell, easy to spread, and easy to believe. But truth? Truth is costly. And nowhere is the cost greater than for mothers in crisis. When a woman is told abortion is her only option, silence and lies surround her. But when she walks into a preborn network clinic, she's met with compassion, support, and the truth about the growing life inside her. That moment of truth happens through a free ultrasound, and it's a game changer. When a mother sees her baby and hears that heartbeat, it literally doubles the chance she will choose life. Preborn Network clinics are on the front lines, meeting women in their darkest hour, loving them, helping them choose life, and sharing the truth. Friend, this is not the time to be silent. It is the time for courage, for truth, and for life. Just $28 provides one ultrasound and the opportunity for a mother to see her baby to help her choose truth and choose life. Please donate today. Call #250 and say baby. That's #250 baby, or give online at preborn.com/AFR. That's preborn.com/AFR.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back, and we are still joined by Gerard Folletti, who is senior counsel of the Lawfare Project. And breaking late yesterday, Attorney General James Uthmeyer here in Florida said on the Sean Hannity show, and you can go to his X page, either Sean Hannity's or the AG, and see this full clip. But the AG says, tonight we filed a lawsuit against Gavin Newsom in California in the U.S. Supreme Court because their so-called sanctuary policies for illegal aliens are harming states like Florida. California must pay for the carnage of their open border policies and unlawful CDL programs. So this is really fascinating. So they're filing for original jurisdiction, you know, state suing another state in the U.S. Supreme Court. Your thoughts on this lawsuit, Gerard?
Oh, it's very interesting, and I think it's aimed at addressing some of the problems that we have with states like California and Illinois giving driver's licenses to illegal immigrants, making it difficult to judge their qualification for even being on America's roads, but also their citizenship status. And we're seeing this as a problem. This is in response, really, this lawsuit is in response to a truck driver who made an illegal U-turn down in Florida and killed three people. And he was here illegally. He had a driver's license in California, and that's what's causing problems. Ultimately, sanctuary states, sanctuary cities that are engaging in policies that are dangerous to American citizens all over. So that's what this lawsuit is trying to address.
Yeah, and I think it's a good one. I mean, whether or not the Supreme Court, ultimately accepts this, but I mean, it's filed on the basis of original jurisdiction. Do you think that that the Supreme Court is more likely to at least take it and hear it because of that, or how do you see the court addressing this?
Well, the court will have to address it. Original jurisdiction is what you have when you have one state suing another. And that's a case that goes directly to the Supreme Court. But ultimately, it's whether there is a cause of action. And I'm not sure how the court will ultimately hold, whether there is enough here to move forward with a case that's not really a political question, which is non-justiciable. That's how the Supreme Court may rule, that this is not right because it's still a political question. You need something more. But ultimately, this is something that we will see more of, lawsuits like this.
Yeah. And I this is why, you know, I'm so grateful to live in the state of Florida. And I think our AG is doing a great job for filing suits like this because obviously the policies of blue states like California, like my former home state of Colorado, that, you know, give these driver's licenses to illegals are impacting other states like Florida. So hopefully the Supreme Court will take this. You know, we'll see. The other case and the other indictment that happened, that with all the other news we haven't gotten to yet this week, but I wanted to get your take on, Gerard, was, of course, Letitia James, Tish James out of New York, that was indicted on mortgage fraud. And, you know, she's going on this kind of national tour and sounding like she's, you know, some kind of, you know, politician, where she's literally screaming at her audience, you know, saying, "I won't back down," and all of this. And she's claiming, of course, that this is Lawfare, but this seems like a pretty straightforward mortgage fraud indictment, you know, that has nothing really to do with any sort of politics, unlike her saying during her campaigning for her position that she was going to target Donald Trump and clearly expressed her willingness to participate in Lawfare. How do you see this?
what's that saying? People in glass houses shouldn't throw stones. And now we're beginning to see what Letitia James is really all about. It's not just the indictment, but now there's a new report out that suggests she may have been harboring her fugitive niece in her house, letting her live rent-free there, the very house that's at issue in this indictment. So we start asking more and more questions about who Tish James really is and the nature of her character and how willingly she is to violate the law, even when she's an attorney general and she knows that her niece should be reporting to probation and not absconding. So really, this is an issue of it's let's follow the facts. Let's see who these people are. If they make public pronouncements that they will prosecute someone for electoral points, which she seems to have done, then it's only fair to look at them and see what crimes they've committed when they actually have.
Right. And this just seems so incredibly brazen that that if the facts alleged in the indictment are true and, you know, found to be proven in court, that for as high of position as she is, I mean, as attorney general, that she would think that she's above the law and be able to commit these types of acts, I mean, and mortgage fraud. I mean, it just goes to show that Democrats really do think that they are above the law and somehow insulated from accountability.
No, absolutely. And if you want to break it down into the essence, it's a type of financial fraud that in many ways is victimless. So it's pretty similar to what she was accusing Donald Trump of. But that just shows you that Democrats play by different rules. What's permissible for them is not permissible for anyone else. And when they get caught doing it, they argue that it's because people are racist or because she was going after Donald Trump, and it's vindictive instead of just playing by the rules as we all try to do.
Yeah. And you know, our friend Will Chamberlain posted kind of a lengthy post on X about this. And if you go in and go to Will Chamberlain's X and search just for Tish James or Letitia James, you know, this is one of the top hits on that. And I won't read the whole thing, but basically what he's saying, which I agree with, Gerard, is that, you know, this isn't a novel theory. There's no use of a 200-year-old statute that hasn't been charged in who knows how long. No repurposing of an obstruction statute to cover behavior that's not contemplated. I mean, if the complaint is true, James literally just told the banks that she would use the property as a second home and then rented it out to tenants. And by lying about her intended use of the property, she got a lower rate from the banks than she would have otherwise. So this just seems like a straightforward mortgage fraud case. So what could possibly be her defense? I mean, just going potentially for jury nullification or suggesting that, you know, she wouldn't have been prosecuted but for, you know, her political prosecution of Donald Trump?
Oh, I think that's absolutely what she's going to try to do. I think she's going to try to dismiss the indictment. She's going to argue that this is political retribution, that it's a constitutional violation to try to prosecute her at all. At the end of the day, I don't think any of these will fly, and she will actually have to put on a defense, which is quite frankly hard to do in cases like this. It's pretty binary. It's black or white. You can try to say that you didn't know what you were signing, but that's not an easy claim to make when you are an attorney and an attorney general. So I think that she has very limited options here other than to make a political spectacle and try to make this case about politics and aim for jury nullification.
Yeah, which of course she's already doing and making this a political spectacle. But what about the jurisdiction that this case arises in? I mean, is this something where there may be problems with the venue or, you know, problems with a judge that may be, you know, more or less politically biased?
That's always an issue. That's always a consideration. We're talking about Virginia, where we have a lot of heavily blue Democrat voters and government officials who right now they're also perhaps being impacted by the government shutdown and wondering whether they'll actually get fired. So there is the potential that the jury is more inclined towards her, and the judge certainly will be giving her every benefit, as judges tend to do to defendants, to make sure that due process is, you know, that the process is carried out. But ultimately, I think most jurors look at a case like this and they do take the politics out of it. They say, you know, we would not do something like this. If we did this, we would be prosecuted. So let's look at the facts and let's judge this accordingly. I think that she can get a fair trial, but more importantly, I think the prosecutors can get a fair shake.
Yeah, good. And because if it was anybody else, they would be prosecuted and wouldn't be able to claim, you know, political retribution and all of this other nonsense. So it'll be interesting to see how this case progresses. But Gerard Folletti, really appreciate you sticking with us through the whole show. And for your legal analysis, as always, you can reach me and my team, Jenna, at AFR.net.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.
Preborn's whole mission is to rescue babies from abortion and lead their families to Christ. Last year, Preborn's network of clinics saw 8,900 mothers come to Christ. Please join us in this life-saving mission. To donate, go to preborn.com/AFR.